You're tuned to KZSC Santa Cruz 88.1 FM. My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. Today, my very special guest on the telephone is Alex Vitali. He is Associate Professor of Sociology at Brooklyn College. He's written a lot of articles, including recently in the New York Daily News, The Nation, USA Today, and The New Republic. He serves on the New York State Advisory Committee to the United States Commission on Civil Rights. His brand new book, coming out on October 10th, is called The End of Policing, and it's been published by Verso. And Alex Vitali, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Hi there.
Hi.
So this book, The End of Policing, on the very front of the book, it says, the problem is not police training, police diversity, or police methods. The problem is the dramatic and unprecedented expansion and intensity of policing in the last 40 years, a fundamental shift in the role of police in society. The problem is policing itself. And I want to add in that near the opening of the book, you also write that excessive use of force is just the tip of the iceberg of over-policing. And in recent years, we've seen a lot of videotaped evidence of excessive use of force, but you're saying that's just the tip of the iceberg. And also that things like more accountability and intensified training fail to deal with the fundamental problems inherent to policing. Tell us a little about the overall picture of the problem of policing.
So, you know, you mentioned these awful high-profile incidents that often result in the death of someone, and this has been the kind of leading indicator of a problem, and it gets the media attention. But then we also need to understand that this expansion of policing is tied very intimately to mass incarceration and the explosion of prison populations over the last 40 years. But the problem goes even deeper than that. There are millions and millions of ultimately unnecessary and counterproductive punitive interactions between police and the public occurring every year in the United States. Ticketing for minor infractions, stopping and searching people without probable cause in many cases, much less reasonable suspicion, the harassment, the non-arrest threats and coercive behavior of police that are targeted almost exclusively in poor communities and communities of color, and that this has produced a profound crisis in confidence in policing in these communities. And I think Ferguson is a great example in a way, because the response to what happened to Mike Brown was never just about Mike Brown. As the Department of Justice showed, it was about a fundamental misuse of police in Ferguson as a tool of revenue collection that essentially criminalized broad swaths of the population, not in an effort to produce public safety, but in an effort to produce cash flow through fines and ticketing and bail funds and these kinds of things. So rather than play around at the margins trying to make police a little bit friendlier and a little bit more respectful, we need to fundamentally challenge the kinds of things that police have been asked to do and look for evidence-based alternatives that will more effectively produce public safety.
Say a little more about the racism that you see as being inherent in policing and the history that connects policing in the United States to slavery. And I want to quote you again from your book, End of Policing. In fact, from the chapter two, which is called The Police Are Not Here to Protect You, you write that police exist primarily as a system for managing and even producing inequality by suppressing social movements and tightly managing the behaviors of poor and non-white people. For me, there's two connected and separate things in there, the managing of inequality and suppressing of social movements, which has its own huge history that you write quite a bit about, and then managing the behaviors of the poor and non-white people.
Yeah, so, you know, as much as there's a story about the last 40 years and the expansion of policing, it's also important to point out the deeply problematic roots of policing and their consistent function in society. So I have a long discussion in the book about the historical origins of policing, and sometimes we hear from activists who will relate the emergence of policing to slave patrols, and in response, liberal theorists will say, well, no, policing is after that. It starts in 1829 in London with a civilian police force. It doesn't have anything to do with slavery. And what I argue instead is that the origin of policing is complex and happens simultaneously in different places in relationship to three overlapping important social phenomena of the 19th century, which are colonialism, slavery, and the emergence of an industrial urban workforce, and the need to manage that workforce. And so what I show is, you know, what looks like a civilian police force in London in 1829 was actually derived from the colonial occupation of Ireland, that the Texas Rangers that were held up as a model of frontier policing, their primary function was to exterminate the indigenous population and drive Mexican and Spanish landowners off the land to make way for white colonial settlement, that the Pennsylvania State Police, which was modeled on the U.S. occupation of the Philippines, was created to give mine owners and factory owners a more reliable police force to shoot striking workers. And all these things are interconnected, that slavery in the cities is as important as understanding what was going on in the countryside with these slave patrols, the management of mobile slaves working on wharves and factories and these kinds of things. So that speaks to the fundamental nature of policing, but that nature has changed and evolved and shifted over time, so it takes a different form today, but that functional role of being a force that is there to manage inequalities in relationship to immigrants, in relationship to social movements, in relationship to populations that have been segregated, impoverished, socially and politically alienated, and when those folks express the consequences of that, either as crime, disorder, disruptive politics, policing is there to give this appearance of neutral law enforcement, but is always reinforcing a pre-existing inequality. So there's a classic line about, well, the law forbids both the poor and the rich from sleeping under bridges or begging for bread. But of course, the rich don't need to do those things. Only the poor do. And I'll just give one little more concrete example. There's a reason why in Ferguson, the enforcement of the traffic laws came down so heavily on the black population there, and that's because poor people have fewer resources to maintain their cars, to pay fines quickly, and so they accumulate and mushroom. And so what appears to be on the face racially neutral, in fact, always reinforces existing inequalities.
I'm speaking with Alex Vitale. He's the author of The End of Policing, which has just been published by Verso Books. Would you respond to the question that might arise among listeners? Hey, this guy is saying that the police are not here to protect you. You know, I thought that that's what we were paying them to do. And in fact, in a lot of cities, including Santa Cruz, the police get usually a good chunk of the city budget, about 25-30%. So how would you answer that when people say, you know, well, I thought that's what the police were for. And even, you know, some people would say, I've I have called the police, and they did show up, and they did help in a violent situation or something. And I guess the second part to that question is about solutions and alternatives, which you offer quite a few of in your book. If the police are not here to protect us, who can we know is there to protect us?
Yeah, I think the principle in the book is that communities have real disorder and crime and public safety problems. The problem is that they have been told that the primary mechanism for dealing with those problems is policing, and that the tools that police have to resolve those problems are arrests and tickets and the use of force and threats and harassment, and that if communities were offered a full range of government services, community resources to try to address their problems, they would generally not choose the police if there was an alternative available to them. But that alternative just isn't provided. And so we've created an ideology through television, through the statements of elected officials, et cetera, that public safety equals policing and punishment. And we've really kind of created a culture of revenge that equates justice with incarceration. And what I'm asking us to do is to rethink that equation, to establish some principles for how we solve our problems, that the solution should be cost-effective. They should really actually resolve the problem, not just cycle people endlessly through jails and emergency rooms and homeless shelters and mental health without ever really addressing their problem. We should do it in a way that's at the lowest reasonable cost. We should do it within a lawful framework. And we should do it in a way that protects people's dignity as much as we possibly can. And unfortunately, policing often fails in all three of these measures. So that when no other resource is available, we will sometimes call the police. But how often do the police really resolve the underlying problem that we've called them about? And in fact, how often do they make that problem worse? Andrea Ritchie's new book, Invisible No More, has a great discussion about the ways in which women often get further victimized by police, either intentionally or unintentionally by the way police handle these calls, rather than being made whole or truly being protected, that they are treated as second-class citizens, that they are re-victimized by police who doubt their stories, who end up arresting them, etc. So it is certainly true that some people benefit from this aggressive and invasive policing. It's folks who rarely see the police, for whom the police often act on their behalf. But for those who are the subject of intensive and invasive policing, it produces profound injustices.
My name is John Malkin. This is Transformation Highway. You're listening to KZSC Santa Cruz, 88.1 FM. I'm speaking with Alex Vitale about the end of policing. You describe the criminal justice system in the United States as a revenge factory, and probably a lot of people are familiar with Michelle Alexander's book and idea of the new Jim Crow. And I was delighted to see you, Alex, mention in your book Alfie Cohn, who I really appreciate a lot in terms of his analysis of education and how we do use in many, many realms of our lives punishment and even the use of rewards as a way of manipulating people. And in the chapter from your book called School to Prison Pipeline, you mentioned Alfie Cohn has this little saying, TKLP, treating kids like pets, which has played out with school resource officers being becoming prevalent in schools in the United States. Say more about the revenge factory and punishment and the way our culture hasn't embraced other methods, for example, restorative justice, which does seem like quite a positive possibility.
So Alfie was really helpful with this because I had written an earlier piece about problems with school policing, and he kindly reached out to me and made me aware of some of his thinking about this, and we had some back and forth, and so I really appreciated his willingness to do that, and I hope it makes that chapter stronger. I think that chapter about school policing is, in my mind, like the least defensible aspect of policing. Its origins are deeply problematic. The research shows that it's almost entirely counterproductive, and it is totally unnecessary, and we know what we could do instead of relying on armed police to produce public safety in schools. So you mentioned restorative justice. That's certainly one model that is getting some attention and needs to be dramatically expanded. We need to put systems in place that understand that justice is about co-producing public safety in a way that allows people to be full productive participants in a community rather than creating these arbitrary lines between these are the good people and these are the bad people, and the bad people are going to be driven out. Because the complexities, especially of youthful behavior, do not lend themselves to this kind of simplistic thinking. And the main effect of that is the criminalization of large numbers of young people that is completely counterproductive. We could also look at things like community schools, where we use schools as a resource center, not just for young people, but for their families and for their communities. You know, a lot of the public safety and disruption problems we have in schools can't be solved by teachers, can't be solved by police, can't even be solved by a few counselors. These are deep problems rooted in communities and the families of these young people, and until we start addressing those problems, we're going to continue to have problems in the delivery of education. We have decades of research that shows that the majority of factors that determine educational success are completely outside the school and are just not. We want to blame teachers for educational failure, and this is totally misguided, and it's intentional. It's designed to get us to ignore the problems of profound segregation in housing and in the delivery of education services, the gross inequalities of resources available for school districts to provide education, and those kinds of solutions have to be in the mix as well.
Leo Tolstoy once wrote that government is violence. That I consider quite often. It's a pretty concise little statement that the state, including the police, have the corner on the use of violence. And at the same time, we are led to believe that if some of us use violence in what's deemed an inappropriate way, we'll be punished. What about this overall structure that is based on coercion and control? I mean, it seems to me that no matter the diversity training or other types of training that police might get, if they're primarily getting trained in using, practicing threatening or using violence, that's the dominant tool that they will use.
Well, you know, in addition to War and Peace, I highly recommend Tolstoy's writings on peace and nonviolence. He was an incredibly deep thinker about these topics and tried to practice many of these ideas in his own life. Policing should be understood as inherently coercive. It is the coercive arm of the state. That's what differentiates it from everything else that government does. It is the sole legitimate user of force on behalf of the state in the domestic arena. And so there may be circumstances where that is necessary. You know, there are predators. There will be people who will take advantage, who will use force and violence to take advantage. And so we need to have some ability to respond to that. But we should not then believe that policing is well suited for all kinds of other things. It should always be understood as the tool of last resort because of its inherently coercive, punitive, and violent character. And so the problem is we have made it the tool of first resort for so many social problems. And I don't think it's wise to imagine that somehow we're going to radically transform policing by instituting a handful of training changes like cultural diversity and implicit bias and de-escalation training, because that fundamentally misunderstands the primary role and nature of policing, and that's not going to change. And what it does is it leaves officers in an untenable circumstance where they are told in the bulk of their training about how to use force and about why they need to use force, but then in some circumstances they're supposed to do the exact opposite. How are they supposed to know which circumstance is which? I don't think it's realistic. I think instead we have to dramatically scale back their role so that they are in far fewer situations in which they might end up using that force or abusing their authority. Because that authority is so powerful and so unchecked that it will always be at risk of abuse. And so if you look at not just these horrible interactions that produce death, not just mass incarceration, but the everyday harassment, most of it is in the service of goals that are unjust. And I'll just give you one example, the war on drugs, which also Michelle Alexander talks about at length. Police should not be involved in drug enforcement, period. It is entirely counterproductive, entirely ineffective. We've had a war on drugs for 40 years, and drugs are easily available to anyone who wants them. I'm sure any high school student in Santa Cruz can get any kind of drugs they want whenever they want them. And criminalizing drugs does nothing to make communities safer or improve public health. We have strategies that are available that will, but we won't use them because we rely on the police. And that, if we just eliminated that form of policing, this could bring about a dramatic reduction in these horrible interactions between police and the public.
Would you illustrate a little more about some actual places that have legalized drugs and what's happened there regarding criminal activity and policing?
So there are a couple of different models out there. One is a decriminalization model. So, for instance, Portugal has decriminalized all drugs. And what that means is that drugs are still bought on the street and from dealers, and it has a black market quality to it, but we've taken the role of the police away and created, in essence, a kind of free black market. So the result has been reductions in overdoses, reductions in HIV and hepatitis C transmission rates, and even reductions over time in the levels of drug usage. It's eliminated police corruption in these areas. It's eliminated police harassment. It's eliminated big driving of people into the criminal justice system. And Portuguese civilization has not collapsed. Everything is okay, and in fact, things look a lot better. Another model would be a legalization model, like you have in Colorado, where the possession of marijuana is legal. You can even have some sharing and some home growing, but the sale of marijuana is regulated and tightly regulated. There are very specific places you can buy it. There's oversight of how these businesses operate, and there's a regime for taxation. My feeling is that we should look towards a scheme for legalization that involves some regulation and taxation, but it has to be reasonable. Otherwise, you just will foment the creation of more black markets. You can use some of those tax revenues then and some of the savings from the war on drugs to invest in poor communities where people have gotten involved in drug dealing as an employment option of last resort. We could think of it as a down payment on a kind of system of reparations, if you want, or we could just think of it as a program for economic development for communities that really need it. And what we'll find if we do this is very positive outcomes. You know, civilization has not collapsed in Colorado because now people can just go into a store and buy marijuana. And it won't collapse if they can also go in and buy cocaine and ecstasy, because people can buy that stuff anytime they want to now. Better that we regulate it and tax it and use some of that money for economic development and public health purposes, drug treatment on demand, safe injection facilities, real, reliable, non-coercive, non-moralizing public health messaging, like, hey, that drug does have some consequences if you use it, and you should be aware of that, and don't mix it with this drug, and don't take it with alcohol. But right now, all our public health messaging is just wagging a finger at people saying, just say no, and that does not help, and it also does not work.
Keith McHenry is the co-founder of Food Not Bombs, and he now lives quite a bit of his time in Santa Cruz, and he serves food still to largely homeless populations in the area, and has also been really active in opposing the militarization of the Santa Cruz Police Department and ongoing criminalization of the homeless. In your book, Alex Vitale, The End of Policing, you have some data on 187 cities in the United States and how they have criminalized homelessness. Of 187 cities, 33% have camping bans against sleeping in specific spots, 18% have a total ban on sleeping in public, 25% have begging restrictions, 53% prohibit sitting or lying in designated zones. All of those things are true in Santa Cruz. 43% of cities make it illegal to sleep in your car, and 9% make it have a law against sharing free food, which obviously has a lot to do with Food Not Bombs. Say something about the criminalization of homelessness.
You know, the criminalization of Food Not Bombs, specifically in San Francisco in the late 80s and early 90s, played a role concretely in my thinking about this, that it really called into question this liberal myth that police are about producing public safety. Because here was a group whose goal was to provide direct material aid to homeless people in the context of making an advocacy for fair programs around housing and substance abuse treatment, mental health services, and that this could be paid for easily out of the military budget. And rather than engaging in some kind of real dialogue with them, rather than actually addressing their claims and concerns, they were arrested repeatedly over time in an effort to say that this kind of activity is fundamentally legitimate. Leave it up to the state to solve this. And what resources did the state put into this? Heavy-handed policing to try to drive people out of public spaces and criminalize basic bodily functions. And it's outrageous. It's just outrageous that we have allowed mass homelessness to become normative in our society. We just had a report here in New York just today that 10% of all high school students in New York City are homeless as high school students. And this is outrageous. And what is our governmental response to this? Bring in the police. Create police homeless outreach units. Criminalize all these aspects of homelessness. And basically, we've given up on the idea that the state is capable of dealing with this problem. And at the root of this is a bipartisan consensus that austerity is the only way to go. That the only thing that government can do is subsidize the very richest people in hopes that they'll stick around, hire a few assistants, pay some taxes, but not very much, and mostly their assistants will get them to pay taxes, and that everyone else who complains or acts out has to be criminalized. It's a really cynical, corrosive politics that both parties are invested in, and they refuse to directly intervene in housing and employment markets, in the delivery of health care at the level that's necessary to counteract the profound polarization along lines of race and class and gender that are tearing this society apart. And so we've got to get at that toxic politics, ultimately, if we're going to reduce the kind of heavy-handed over-policing that is part of this problem.
I want to thank Keith McHenry for putting me in touch with you, Alex, and telling me about your book. I am speaking today with Alex Vitale. He's the author of The End of Policing, which has just been released by Verso Books. Very, very often now, unfortunately, we see in the news that someone in the United States has taken automatic weapons and gone to a school or gone to a shopping mall and shot random people. Just recently, there was this horrific, very massive shooting in Las Vegas. Our culture has a lot of violence in it and a very violent history. So you have a section of your book called Disarm the Police, and it talks about SWAT teams and the popular culture and how violent police are in the United States compared to other places. And I think, you know, I hear quite often people say, oh, I think that in Great Britain and some other places, police didn't used to carry guns, but now I think they do, and everyone's kind of having a lot of guns now. But I think the reality is that there is a lot more police violence in the United States than most of the rest of the world. In your book, you mentioned that since 1900, the year 1900, UK police have killed 50 people. And in March 2016 alone, United States police killed 100 people just in 1 month. So I guess, you know, two parts to what I'm curious about, the underlying roots of the violence in our culture and the part that police play in that.
So most police in the UK still do not carry weapons. If you go out on patrol and you see a police officer, they are not armed. They have a small number of officers who are available for armed response, but they do not handle regular calls. So, and this is true in some other parts of Europe and some other places in the world. So that model of unarmed policing still exists, and police officers in these places are rarely harmed as a result of that. However, it's certainly true that the situation around violence is very different here, and we can't talk about disarming the police in the absence of a strategy for reducing gun violence. which doesn't just take the form of mass shootings or, you know, confrontations with the police. It happens in a lot of different kinds of neighborhoods, and of course, it's a major contributor to suicide rates and domestic violence and everything, and accidental shootings, etc. I am very skeptical about the discourse around gun control. This is a supply-side strategy, just like drug prohibition is, that I don't think is going to work, in part because we do have a Second Amendment, however it's been interpreted, and the country is awash in guns. There are more guns than people, and we're just not going to get rid of the guns, even if we tried to. Australia did. Different culture, different moment. And yes, the NRA is a toxic lobby for the gun industry, and I'm down with all that. But what's missing is a true demand-side strategy. So I had a piece in the Independent, with a Y, Independent, recently here in New York about the Las Vegas shooting. It's also on the Verso blog attached to my book, that says that we have to understand the role of racial animus, toxic masculinity, anti-government privatization rhetoric that all contribute to the stockpiling of guns, this mania about open carry that says that we can't even trust the state to provide basic protection, so we're going to privatize that by just putting a gun in every hand, and that somehow good guys with guns will win out. Well, that, of course, that was absolutely no help in Las Vegas. And if people had had guns at that concert, the first person who took his gun out would have been shot by another person with a gun, like, oh, there's the shooter. And then as soon as he shoots that guy, someone sees him shooting, oh, there's the shooter, I'm going to shoot him. Everybody's shooting everybody. So that's where that kind of approach gets us. For inner city kids, for violent neighborhoods, why are young people picking up guns as a tool of empowerment? Often because they're not safe. They don't feel safe. They don't feel secure. And no amount of intensive, coercive, invasive policing has succeeded in making them feel secure, because what it does is it harasses them instead of solving their problems. So we need to look at things like violence interrupters that go out in communities and talk to young people about ways of producing safety other than carrying guns and using them. And we have to look at the underlying political problems in our society that are producing this kind of toxic libertarianism that is taken to this extreme violent form, and begin to directly address these things. And our politicians instead prefer to hide behind these kinds of fake legislative efforts around gun control that, A, are never going to pass, and, B, even if they did, almost never directly address the actual gun issues that are involved. And that just empowers the conservatives to say that, you know, gun control is a completely misguided endeavor.
One of the final sections of your book, The End of Policing, it's on political policing, and you write that in the United States, police have always focused on detecting and disrupting movements that threaten the economic and political status quo. And you mentioned COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, and more currently, the use of joint terrorism task forces and fusion centers. And a few years ago, Santa Cruz police got money from Department of Homeland Security grants to buy automatic license plate readers. And I ended up doing a lot of research and wrote some articles about ALPRs and also the connection of collecting data and putting it in centralized places like fusion centers, which now cross the country. Tell us a little about how police have been used as political maneuvers and what the significance is of joint terrorism task forces and fusion centers now.
So political policing has always been at the center of policing. Despite its claims of political neutrality, this has never been the case. Police have always taken sides in the interests of, you know, maintaining certain basic inequalities. They have always been involved in the suppression of workers' movements and the suppression of marginal populations. And this continues today. And when people try to organize to question the systems that are oppressing them, they are placed under police scrutiny that in ways that have nothing to do with breaking the law. So that in to come to the attention of police and to be placed under police surveillance doesn't require that you do anything illegal. It requires that you have radical beliefs. And this has been consistent throughout the history of policing. Now, periodically, we lose track of this because social movements are not strong or not powerful, or we don't have information about what's going on in these hidden rooms where files are being kept and surveillance is being analyzed. But this is going on all the time, and it is very well documented going back through time. What we know today is that the Black Lives Matter movement has been defined as an extremist movement, even in the absence of any criminal behavior, that the FBI is keeping files on people, that local police departments are keeping files on people. We have had some leaks of documents and some court cases around freedom of information requests that have produced documentation that shows that this happens. We know that they use informants, that they put police undercover in these organizations, even in the absence of any accusation of criminal behavior. And so we must always, always question and move to restrict the use of police in these political ways, because it is corrosive to any kind of notion of democracy, and it is dangerous. But we also have to avoid, I think, the kind of paranoia that can seep into movements that are subjected to police surveillance, and work to make our movements as broad and open as possible, which is a way of making them much more immune to the kinds of dirty tricks that police will often engage in.
Alex Vitale is the author of The End of Policing, which has just been released this month, October 10th, 2017, by Verso Books. And I have long envisioned the end of policing. When do you think we might actually see that happen? And if you would wrap up with some of the alternatives and solutions you're talking about to help create the end of policing.
Well, I think we have to understand this as a process, not as an end point, that rather than starting from the premise of imagining a world without policing, what I say is imagine ways of producing public safety, and let's pursue those in really concrete ways. Ithaca, the city of Ithaca in upstate New York, recently undertook a process for looking at its drug problems. And they brought in experts, they brought in community leaders, they had nights after nights of discussions and presentations, and out of that came what was called the Ithaca Plan. And it was an attempt to develop a comprehensive response to the opioid epidemic and the problems that that's producing. And it involved drug treatment on demand, the creation of safe injection facilities, public health messaging. What it did not involve is some kind of expansion of policing. And so that's about a process that attempts to solve problems without assuming that the only tool you have is police. Similarly, we've got to look at why we've given police responsibility to deal with people's sexual lives, why we're treating our young people as criminals instead of people who are in need of assistance, and calling them gangbangers and engaging in all this hateful rhetoric that we see coming out of the Trump administration, why we're criminalizing immigrants instead of trying to integrate them into our society. You know, you show me the social problem, mental illness, et cetera, and we can talk about concrete evidence-based solutions that don't involve policing. And I think people, wherever they are, can look for campaigns where people are doing this work and try to figure out how to help them. So let's start with those concrete struggles and let's see how far we can take them.
Alex Vitale, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for joining me today.
You're most welcome.
Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing. This is KZSC Santa Cruz, 88.1 FM. My name is John Malkin. This is Transformation Highway.